chairs, grazing among the green. Grattan taps his fingers on the steering wheel. And then, of course, Peg went off on him. Sean looks back again. He doesn't say anything, but just waits. I see how it pulls the words out of Grattan and gives Sean a subtle upper hand, and I vow to learn how to use this technique. Well, he was saying that if he was on that red stallion of yours, he'd be a four-time winner too. So Peg told him he didn't know a thing about horses if he thought all there was to the race was the horse under you. She had a short fuse this morning, because it was a day that ended with Y, you see. I laugh, which reminds Grattan that I'm there, because he says, And of course, you don't need Mutt Malvern for competition. You've got your hands full with Puck right here. I vow to poison Thomas Grattan slowly later. I want to sink into the seat and disappear. But instead, I glare at Sean, daring him to say something. But he doesn't. He just looks at my face, frowning a little, as if somehow my reasons for disrupting his training will reveal themselves. Then he glances back out the window. I can't decide if I'm insulted or not. To not say anything at all seems worse than saying something awful. I turn to Thomas Grattan, ignoring Sean Kendrick. You said you were looking for an apprentice.
That's the truth.
What about Beach? Grattan says.
Beach is going to the mainland after the races.
I open my mouth, but no sound comes out.
He and Tommy Fork and your brother Gabriel are all going at the same time. I should thank you, Puck, for giving us a few more weeks with him. I hear that your brother's staying until after the race because of you being in it, and that held them all up.
I feel, sometimes, like the rest of Thisbe knows more about my business than I do.
That's the truth,
I say, repeating what he said. I feel darker, for some reason, now that I know that Gabe's not going alone.
Tommy's racing, though, isn't he?
Yeah, he decided to, since he's going to be here for it.
Are you upset about Beach? After I say it, I realize it might not be the most sensitive thing to ask. But I can't unask it.
Ah, that's the way of this island. Not everyone can stay, or we'd fall off the edges, wouldn't we?
Thomas Grattan's voice doesn't match his light words, though.
And not everyone belongs to this island. I can tell you do, don't you?
I'd never leave, I say fervently. It's like my heart or something.
I feel silly for being so sentimental. Outside the window, across the water, I can see one of the tiny rocky islands near us, a little blue silhouette, too small to be inhabited. It's beautiful, in the sort of way that you never get used to. We're all quiet, very quiet. And then Sean Kendrick says,
I have another horse, Kate Connolly, if you want to ride one of the Capel Ishka.
Chapter 24 Puck. Finn eyes me as he slowly uses his fingers to rend a biscuit into a pile of crumbs.
So, Sean Kendrick's going to sell you one of the water horses.
We're sitting in the back room of Fathom and Sons. It's a claustrophobic room lined with shelves of brown boxes, the floor barely big enough for the scratched table that stands on it. It smells less like the butter scent of the rest of the building, and more of musty cardboard and old cheese. When we were small, Mum would park us here with some biscuits while she chatted with Dory Maud out front. Finn and I would take turns guessing what was in the brown boxes. Hardware, crackers, rabbit paws, the private parts of Dory Maud's invisible lovers.
Not necessarily, I say,
not looking up from my work. I'm signing and numbering teapots while nursing a cup of tea that's gone regretfully cold.
I'm just looking. He didn't say selling, really.
Finn looks at me.
I didn't say buying either.
I shoot back at him.
I thought you were riding Dove.
I sign my name on the bottom of a pot. Kate Connolly. It looks like I'm signing a school paper. What I need is more flourish. I add a curl to the bottom of the Y
I probably still am, I say.
I'm just looking.
I'm blushing, and I don't know why, which infuriates me. I hope that the little bit of light from the bulb above us and the narrow windows over the shelves doesn't reveal it. I add,
I only have 2 more days to change my horse. I might as well make sure. Are you going to be in the parade of riders?
Finn asks. He's not looking at me now. Having completely taken apart the biscuit, he's begun to squish the crumbs back together into something lumpier and smaller. Every year, the Scorpio Festival is held a week after the horses emerge. I've only been once, and even then, we didn't stay long enough for the parade of riders, which is the culminating event of the night, when the riders declare their official mounts and betting goes crazy. I get a little pit of nerves in my stomach thinking about it.
Yes, are you?
Dory Maud's voice carries into the room. She stands in the doorway, one of her eyebrows arched. She's wearing a dress that looks like she stole it. It has lace sleeves, and Dory Maud does not have lace sleeve arms. I frown at her with bad temper.
You aren't going to try to talk me out of it, are you? The parade or the race?
Dory Maud pulls out the third chair at the table and sits down.
What I don't understand, she says, is why such a clever and useful girl as yourself, Puck, would waste so much time looking like an idiot or being dead.
Finn smiles at his biscuit.
I have my reasons, I snap. And don't tell me that my parents would be so sad about it either. I've already heard it. I've heard it all. Has she been this short all week?
Dory Maud asks Finn, who nods. To me, she adds,
Your father would be displeased, but your mother, she wouldn't have much room to talk. She was a hellion, and the only thing she didn't do on this island was ride in the races.
Really? I ask, hopeful for more information.
Probably, Dory Maud replies. Finn, why are you eating that? It looks like cat food.
Brought it from home, Finn sighs heavily.
At Polson's, they were setting out cinnamon twists.
Oh, yes, Dory Maud begins, scratching something on a piece of paper. Her handwriting is so utterly illegible that I have to believe she works at it.
Even the angels could smell them.
Finn's expression is wistful. I feel guilty about the load of hay and grain I just bought. I'm not sure it's a better investment than cinnamon twist would have been. Could I get an advance on some teapots, Dory Maud? I ask. I push a signed and numbered one toward her, so she is convinced of my dutifulness. Horse food's expensive.
I'm not a bank. If you help me set up the festival booth Friday afternoon, I'll do it.
Thanks, I say, without feeling much gratitude. After a moment, Finn says,
I don't know why you aren't just riding Dove.
Finn.
Well, that's what you said.
I'd like to have a chance of winning money, I say. I thought it might actually help to ride, you know, a water horse in a race for, you know, water horses.
Hmm, remarks Dory Maud. Exactly,
Finn says.
How do you know they're faster?
Oh, please.
Well, you are the one who told me that they don't always go in straight lines. I just don't see why you're changing your mind now, just because some expert told you.
I feel my cheeks warm again. He's not some expert, and he didn't tell me anything. I'm just looking. Finn presses his thumb into his pile of crumbs hard, so that the tip turns white.
You said that you weren't riding one of them on principle, because of Mum and Dad.
His voice is even because Dory Maud is there, and because he's Finn, but I can tell. He's agitated. I say,
Well, principle won't pay the bills. It's not much of a principle when you can just change it like that, overnight, like...
But he must not be able to think of what else it's like, because he stands up and storms past Dory Maud's chair and out of the room. I blink after him. What? What? I think brothers are the most inexplicable species on the planet. Dory Maud brushes invisible crumbs from her paper and studies what she's written.
Boys, she says.
just aren't very good at being afraid.
Chapter 25. Sean. That evening, I saddle up a filly named Malvern Small Miracle, so called because she was so motionless and quiet when she was born that everyone thought she was stillborn. I'm worn and tired. Something's wrong with my right arm where one of the horses jammed it earlier today, and I want nothing more than to crawl into my bed to consider whether or not my meeting tomorrow with Kate Connolly is a poor idea. But there are two buyers here, just off the boat, and words come that I need to show two of the three-year-olds to them while they're still light. Why it won't hold until tomorrow, I don't know. When I walk out into the golden evening yard to meet the buyers, I'm surprised to find that the other filly, a grey named Sweeter, is already out there, someone on her back. It only takes me half a moment to recognize the silhouette as Mutt Malvern's, and something in my gut snarls and turns. Three men stand at her shoulder, their attention on Mutt. He turns his head toward me, face in shadow, and I know he means for me to see that it's him. That he thinks that it's any of his business to be showing Sweeter offends me badly enough, but when I hear him tell one of the buyers how much he loves this filly, all I can think of is him standing at the point of the cove, waiting for Fundamental to be pulled under. Miracle's hot. She skitters sideways and then shoots across the yard to where Mutt stands, bold enough that Sweeter moves out of her way. Our blue shadows stand beneath us. "Sean Kendrick," says George Holly gladly. At my name, the other two buyers turn to observe me. I don't recognize either of them. Fresh blood, perhaps. "Sean will be riding the other filly out," Mutt tells them, his expression paternal. He smiles. "Since I can't ride two at the same time." I'm not sure he can ride one at the same time. I can't remember the last time I've seen him at the gallops. One of the buyers mutters my name to the other, and Mutt leans toward them to ask, "What's that?"
"Kendrick, the name sounds familiar."
Mutt looks at me. "I just ride the horses," I say. George Holly's smile is light in the darkness.
"Are you riding in the race too?"
asks a buyer. I nod. "On the Red Stallion," Holly tells him. "The one you saw earlier." They mumble their appreciation and ask Mutt who he's riding in the races. Mutt sets his jaw. I don't think he even remembers Idana's name. He has yet to ride her. I know this is where I, in the employ of the Malverns, am meant to step in and be helpful and humble to save Mutt's face. It's what I've done for most of my life, and I can feel on my lips the words that will make Mutt look good. The words that will remind the clients of my relative hierarchy in the Malvern yard. But instead I say, "I've chosen the bay mare with the white blaze, Idana, for him. I think they'll be a good match." The yard is silent. There's something coiled and repugnant in Mutt's posture as he fixes his gaze on me. The buyers exchange glances as Holly rocks on his heels. I can see my words burrow under Mutt's skin. I feel untethered and dangerous. Miracle shies at nothing in particular, dancing in place. Her hooves clatter and echo across the stones. I turn to Mutt. I imagine him going beneath the water instead of Fundamental, in Core's grasp, beneath hooves in my father's place.
"Light's failing. Shall we take your fillies out, then?"
Mutt turns Sweeter without a word. The gallop is 7 furlongs, nearly a mile, and straight as an arrow. The horses are spirited as they step onto it, knowing what is coming next. I feel Mutt's gaze on me, and when I meet it, his mouth twists. This was not meant to be a race between Miracle and Sweeter, but I see now that there's no way that it won't be. Sweeter leaps out. Miracle is only a moment behind as I give her some rein. We streak along the pale gallop, its surface striped with blue shadows. The air screams by my ears, cold and painful, The shadows are so heavy that both fillies mistake them for real things and lift their knees, jumping invisible hurdles. Mutt glances over at me to see how far I am, but he needn't bother. We're right on him, shoulder to shoulder. The fillies surge down the track. Speed-wise, I know the fillies are evenly matched, but I also know that only half of racing is how fast your horse is. I've been on this gallop hundreds of times on hundreds of horses, and I know where the incline starts, I know where the ground is soft by the rail, and I know where the horses slow and stare at the tractor parked near the road. I know everything there is to know about Miracle, too. How she likes to run herself out if you don't keep her in check. How much I'll need to push her to keep her strong up the incline. How to wave my crop just a bit to keep her attention on the task at hand and not the tractor. All Mutt knows is how to beat the hell out of his mount as he's losing. I know I should hold Miracle back. I know I should let Mutt and Sweeter finish first. I feel the buyer's eyes on me. I lean forward and whisper to Miracle. Her ear tips back at me, and I release the reins. It's not even a contest. Miracle pulls away from Sweeter by one length, two lengths, three lengths, four, not even breathing that hard. Mutt is bogged down somewhere in the wet ground near the rail, Sweeter slow and inattentive. I turn around, standing in my stirrups, and salute Mutt Malvern with my crop. I know it's a deadly game I'm playing. "Not a jockey," Holly says to me as I walk Miracle back into the yard. "Just a horse lover," I reply.
Chapter 26 Puck. Sean Kendrick told me to meet him at the point of the cliffs over Fellcove, but there's no sign of him when I get there. The cliffs here aren't as high as the ones that border the racing beach, and they're not as pure white. The shore by the cove is a weird, awkward place to get to, and once Dub and I manage to creep down the narrow, uneven path to the beach, I find that it's no good for riding on. The beach here is rocky and uneven, and the sea hugs it closely. It's low tide, but still, there's only 15 feet of rocks before the unruly sea smashes itself against them. It's the sort of place we were always warned against, because a horse could be up out of that ocean and back down with us before one wave had gone out and another taken its place. I wonder, suddenly, if Sean Kendrick sent me here as a prank. Before I have time to consider if he seemed like that sort of person and think something truly foul about him, I hear hoofbeats. I can't tell at once where they're coming from, and then I realize that they're coming from above me. I crane my head up to look. I see a lone horse, stretched out to its fullest, galloping along the edge of the cliff, bits of turf ploughed up beneath its hooves. I recognize the horse a moment before I recognize the rider, Sean Kendrick, folded up tightly along the stallion's back, moving as one with the horse. As a bloody red Kapalishka pounds past me overhead, I see that Sean rides bareback, the most dangerous way of all. Skin to skin, pulse to pulse. Nothing to protect you should the horse's magic seize you. I don't want to admire them, to admit that the two of them together are something altogether different than I've ever seen. But I can't help it. The red stallion is so fast that it steals my breath and speeds my heart with the thrill of it. I thought the horses I saw on the first day of training were fast, but I've never seen a horse move like this before. And Sean Kendrick on him, bareback. He is a pisser for sure, but the old man I met in the butcher's is right. There is something about him. He knows his horses, but there is something else about him too. I think about the way his face felt in my hand when I pulled it above the water. I think, too, about what it would be like to ride a horse like that. A bit of guilt stabs just inside my ribs as I remember Finn and his principles, or rather, my principles, the ones that started to slip when the house was at stake. I wish the idea of this sat more easily with me. Back we go to the top of the cliff, Darth prancing a bit. Even going uphill, even after being ridden well for days now, she's still excited about running. I hear Finn's voice whispering in my ear as she flicks her tail. By the time I get to the top of the cliff road, I know what I'm going to ask Sean.
Sean. There's no sign of Kate Connolly when I arrive at the point of the cliff, though I wait for several long moments, moments I can't spare. I tie the bay mare down, draw a circle around her and spit in it, and take Cor out for a run. If Kate doesn't show up, I'll at least have stretched him out. He's eager and forward today, glad as me for the gallop. Galloping up at the top of this cliff requires a gull's heart and a shark's nerve. It's not as high as the cliffs over the racing beach, sure, but a fall over these would kill you just the same. And to a Capel Ishka, the call of the sea is nearly as powerful 100 feet above it as it is 100 feet across a beach from it. More than one man has ridden that sinking ship over the edge and onto the rocks, just shy of the ocean. But these low cliffs are the first place that my father ever set me on one of the Capel Ishka, not the beach where he had been taught, because always, always, my father feared the sea more than he feared the heights. I think they're both deadly, which isn't the same as being afraid. When I double back, Cor stepping high over the long cliff grass, I see Kate Connolly standing beside her little dun pony. Kate's hair is the color of the cliff grass turned red by autumn, and she has a spatter of freckles across her face that at first glance makes her look far younger. It's a strange magic. At once she's a cross child and also something older and wild, something grown from this coarse island soil. She's looking at my things, my saddle tipped up on its pommel, my rucksack, my thermos, my bells, where I've left them. And for some reason that makes me feel odd, like skin rubbed raw by sand in the wind. When Kate notices me, she frowns, or at least narrows her eyes. I don't know her to be able to tell the difference. I feel that same disquieted feeling I had in the cove. Again, Fundamental goes under the water, and me with him. But I'm not drowning now. I let out my breath. Cor's inspired by the appearance of the mare. Instead of slowing to a walk, he trots nearly in place, shivering with his excitement. I don't dare get as close to her as politeness demands, so from 15 feet away, Cor dancing beneath me, I say, my voice louder to be heard over the wind, "What do I call you?"
"What?"
I ask.
"Is your name Kate or not?" "Come again." "It says Kate on the board at Grattan's, but that's not what Thomas Grattan called you."
"Puck,"
she says, her voice soaked in lemon juice.
"It's a nickname. Some people call me that."
She doesn't invite me to be one of them. The wind gasps, long and low, around our feet, flattening the grass and tangling through the horses' manes. Up here, for some reason, it always smells more strongly of fish. After a moment, she adds,
"I thought the rules say that you have to train on the beach."
I don't understand her for a moment. Then I clarify,
"Within 150 yards of the shore."
Something dawns over her face, and for a moment, I needn't be there. It is merely her and her epiphany. I look at my watch.
"Where's the other horse?"
she asks. Her mare tries to nibble her hair, and Kate slaps at her absently. The pony tosses her head up with mock displeasure. It's a game bred of familiarity, one that warms me to both of them.
"Just a bit inland."
Kate regards us.
"Does he always do that?"
Cor hasn't stopped moving. His neck is arched, too. I'm sure he looks ridiculous as he preens for them. Ishka stallions generally prefer to view land horses as meals, not mates. But sometimes a particular mare will take a stallion's fancy, and he'll make an idiot of himself.
"The bay mare's worse," I say.
Kate makes a face that I think might be humor.
"Tell me about her,"
She's moody and she's slippery and she's in love with the ocean, I reply. I'd caught her in a rainstorm, salt water making all of my leather straps too slick to hold, clouds turning the sky into sea and vice versa, the cold making my fingers imprecise. She came up in a net behind the boat as I dredged the breakers just off the shore. Local law had it that a Kapil Ishka caught in the rain wanted to stay wet, but I wouldn't believe it until I'd tried it for myself.
That sounds bad, Kate says.
It is.
Then why am I here?
I study her. It's a question that's been plaguing me since I first saw her on the beach. Because she'd be a Kapil Ishka in a race made for Kapil Ishka. She looks past me at the cliff's edge, then, her eyebrows drawn close together, her mouth set. There's something uncompromising about her, a fury that I associate with youth.
I don't want to consider this unless I'm sure she's going to be a better bet than Dove, she says.
It's not until she's been quiet for a long moment that I realize that she's looking at me, waiting for me to agree or disagree. I'm not certain what she expects me to say. She must know all this. But still, I say,
there is nothing faster than a Kapil Ishka, period. I don't care what sort of training regimen you're doing, circles in the surf or whatever. They have strength on your mare. They have height on her, and your mare runs on grass.
The Kapil Ishka run on blood. Kate Connolly, you don't stand a chance. This seems to solidify her opinions, because she nods once, sharply.
Okay, then. So you'll race me then, won't you?
It's a curious way that she phrases it. The won't you means that I'll have to disagree with her just to keep things as normal.
Race? Me on the mare, you on Dove?
Kate nods. The wind buffets us again, finally stilling Cor as he stops to scent it. I can smell rain on it, far away.
I don't understand the purpose.
She just stares at me. Back at the yard, I have two lots of horses to take out to the gallops yet. I have George Holly and at least two other buyers poking around the barns, looking for the horse that will make their mainland yards famous, or at least famous for the year. I have too much to do in too few hours before the October night comes early. I don't have time for a fool's race, a Kapil Ishka against a pony that couldn't begin to look Cor in the eye.
It's no more time than it would take for me to try her, Kate says. So if you say no, it's just because the idea insults you.
Which is how we end up racing. I retrieve the bay mare, leaving Cor in her place with a lump of beef heart from my satchel, and find Kate adjusting her stirrups from the back of her pony, one leg crossed over the saddle as she does. It's something you can't do on a horse you don't trust. Something I don't know that I'd ever do on one of the Kapil Ishka. Beneath me, the bay mare is twisting and anxious. She's as hard to hold as the piebald, but less malevolent. She would sooner drown you than eat you.
Are you ready?
Kate asks me, though I think it's a question I should have been asking instead. I don't think there's even a ghost of a chance she wants this horse I'm on.
To the big outcropping over there?
I nod. I reasoned with myself. This doesn't have to be an entirely wasted exercise. If I can get this bay mare running straight and true for these 5 minutes, then I'll reconsider what I told Malvern. I hate releasing a horse after I've invested time in it, and she's had plenty of time sunk into her. Maybe I was wrong and she will shape up for next year. Cor took years to settle.
Are we waiting for a sign?
Kate says, springing off across the field. The bay mare's after her like a shot, all predator, and I let her have her head until we've caught up. Kate has a big handful of Dove's mane, which I think is for grip, until I realize it's to keep the strands from slapping the girl's hands and face with their length. I don't have to worry about that with the bay mare. She's rubbed most of hers off on the doorframe of her stall, longing for the sea. The two horses gallop through the cliff grass, both of them nimble over the uneven surface. The bay mare's not even really trying. I nudge her to get a bit more speed out of her,
to pull away from Dove and end this, but the mare curves her body around my leg instead of away from it. She tugs toward the cliff edge, moving more to the side than forward. And of course that island pony tracks straight and true ahead of us. It takes me several long seconds to sort my bay mare out again, but when she decides to run, she catches up easily. Gates' dun pony gallops along, joyfully. Her ears are pricked with the glee of the run, her tail cracking every so often as she bucks playfully with excitement. If my mare is not focused, neither is she. Kate glances at me, and I urge the bay mare on. I whisper to her for speed, and she surges forward, listening. The dun mare doesn't stand a chance. I hear a crack over the sound of the wind in my ears and turn just in time to see that Kate has reached behind her and, with her open palm, slapped her mare on the haunches, hard. It's gotten her pony's attention, and Dove charges forward, giving it everything. It's no good, though. My Capel Ishka has more speed than any island pony has dreamt of, and we're pulling away fast. We'll have 30 lengths between us by the time we make it to the outcropping. The bay mare stumbles but doesn't lose her footing. My arms are sprayed with bits of mud. I steal a glance under my arm to see where Kate is. She and her pony are far, far behind. There's no thrill to this race. No pleasure in such an easy victory. Above all, no joy in a win that the horse has no interest in. And that's when the wind throws the scent of the sea at us. The bay mare flags and then twists. Throwing her head up, her nostrils flared. I whisper to her and trace letters on her shoulder. But she won't settle. She wants that cliff edge. The ocean is thick in the wind and she cannot think for it. I shuffle my iron out of my pocket, trace it along her veins. But nothing. She rears, clawing at the air, and when that doesn't unseat me, she decides to take me with her. Her skin's hot and charged where my leg touches her. Nothing I do to her will turn her head. Before us, I see cliff grass, and more cliff grass, and then, beyond it, nothing but sky. I pop one rein up, a dangerous way to stop a normal horse as you could pull it onto yourself. But it makes no difference to the bay mare. She has the bit solidly in her teeth and the sea in her lungs. 20 feet to the edge. I have half a heartbeat to make a decision. I throw myself off her, slamming my shoulder hard into the ground and rolling to defuse the blow. I see chestnut-colored grass, then blue sky, then chestnut-colored grass again. Pushing myself up on my elbow, I catch sight of the mare just in time to watch her bunch her muscles and leap. I scramble as close to the cliff's edge as I dare. I'm not sure if I can stand to see her dash herself on the rocks below, but I can't not look either. The bay mare looks fearless as she sails through the air, as if it's no more than a casual leap over a hurdle. Already she looks less horse-like, her body streamlined. I can't look. I hear a terrific crash. She has disappeared into the surf, her tail the last thing I see. I sigh and put my hands in my pockets. I can't tell if she survived the dive or not. My saddle's gone either way. I'm glad it wasn't my father's back at the barn, though it was still dear. I'd had it made for me 2 years ago, a rare indulgence. I don't swear, but I consider the shape of the word in my mouth. Hot breath wafts out on my shoulder. It's Dove and Kate standing on the other side of her, her ginger hair all pulled out of its ponytail. Dove is out of breath, but not as much as I'd expect. Kate looks over the cliff and frowns for a moment, and then she points. I follow her gaze to a glistening dark back swimming out to sea. My mouth quirks. It looks like you won, Kate Connolly. She pats Dove's shoulder and says, "Call me Puck." Chapter 27. Sean. I get back to the yard and find it in disarray. Half the horses didn't make it out for their exercise on time. Metal is up in the paddock by the stable, chewing and sucking steadily on the top board of the fence. Adana hasn't been taken out at all, and there's no sign of Mutt. If he's thinking that he means to challenge me and Cor at the races this year, he's going about it the wrong way. I keep feeling I've forgotten to do something, until I realize that I'm disconcerted by leaving with two horses and returning with one. I've no horse to untack, no saddle to put away. George Holly finds me just as I'm walking back into the yard, a blood-streaked bucket in my hand from feeding the Kapil Ishka. He's found a brilliant red flat cap to hold his hair down and a smile to hold his face on. "Hello, Mr. Kendrick," he greets me brightly, falling into step with me across the cobbles of the yard. "You look in fine spirits."
"Do I?"
"Well, your face looks like it remembers a smile," Holly says. He looks down at my clothing. I'm wearing the island all over my left side. I kick on the hose pump with my knee and begin to rinse the bucket over the top of the drain. "I lost a horse today."
"That sounds careless. What happened?"
"She jumped off a cliff."
"A cliff? Is that normal?"
In the barn, Adana lets out a keening, impatient wail, hungry for the sea. This time last year, Mutt was already pounding the hell out of his chosen mount on the beach. Right now, the yard seems quiet without him, the blue sky before a storm. I think about the Scorpio Festival tomorrow, how the riders' parade this year will be me and Mutt and insane Kate Connolly. I shut off the water pump and regard him. "Mr. Holly, nothing about this month is turning out to be normal."
Chapter 28 Puck. So tonight is the night of the great Scorpio Festival. I've only been to the Scorpio Festival once. Mum took us one year while Dad was out on the boat. Dad didn't approve of the festival, or the races in general. He said that one bred hooligans and that the other gave those hooligans two more legs than they could steer. We'd always thought Mum didn't approve either. But still, that year when it became clear that Dad wasn't going to be back that evening, Mum told us to fetch our hats and coats and told Gabe to kick the Morris into life. It was dodgy even back then. With illicit fervor, we piled in. Gabe took the coveted passenger seat while Finn and I fought and slapped each other in the back seat. Mum shouted at us and tore along the little road to Skarmouth, bent over the steering wheel like it was a troublesome horse. And then Skarmouth. Everywhere there were costumes and the Scorpio drummers and the wail of the singers. Mum bought us bells and ribbons and November cakes, which made my hands sticky for days. Everywhere, noise, 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 until Finn, who was just a little urchin then, had started to cry from it. Dory Maud whirled over from nowhere with one of the terrifying curse masks and put it on Finn. Hidden behind the flat-tooth monster mask, he became as fierce as my mother. Over the years that I knew Mum, I more often saw her mucking Dove's lean-to or cleaning pots or painting pottery or leaning up against the roof to smack a shingle back on with a hammer. But for some reason, now, when I call up thoughts of Mum, I remember that night at the festival, her dancing wildly in a circle with us, a mouth full of glinting teeth, face strange in the firelight, singing the November songs. And now it's years later, and it's the day of the festival, and we can go if we want to, because there's no one alive to tell us otherwise. It's a strange and hollow feeling. "I got the Morris running," Finn says now, coming into the house. He regards my dishwashing with more interest than dishwashing warrants. "It took a while." I believe him. He's grubby and black. "You look like homemade sin," I tell him. "What are you doing?" Instead of heading to the bathroom to clean up, he's fetching his coat, which has fallen onto the floor behind Dad's sitting chair by the fire. Finn rubs his forehead, leaving a black smear. "I'm afraid to turn the Morris off or it might not start again." "You can't let it run all night." My brother puts on his lumpy hat. "I can't believe Mum called you the clever one." "She didn't. She called Gabe that," I say. As he puts his hand on the door, I realize where he thinks he's going.
Wait! You think you're going to the festival?
Finn just turns and gives me a look.
Gabe's not even here. Why do you think we're going? I have to be up early. Because you have to go finalize your registration, Finn says. That's what your rule sheet says.
Of course he's right. I feel foolish for not remembering it. And then I feel my stomach drop to my feet. Before, I had a few yards of seawater between me and everyone who might say something about me being in the races. Now, the only thing between me and everyone else will be a few pints of beer. But there's no way around it. And maybe, just maybe, Gabe will be there. The rest of the island will be. Unreluctantly, I abandon the dishwashing, and reluctantly, I find my ratty green coat and get my hat as Finn flings open the door. Now that I know to look for it, I can see that he's crawling out of his skin with excitement. Finn never looks more excited. He just gets faster. Finns are generally slow-moving creatures. The Morris looks ominous under the darkening pink sky, the widening black hands of clouds stretching across a sunset. But Finn's face is a shining beacon in the driver's seat as he waits for me. I think of him behind Dory Moore's fearsome curse mask and imagine him that happy again, his fingers sticky for days. Wait, I say, and run back inside to pull a few slender coins from the increasingly shallow collection in the biscuit tin on the counter. I will find a way to earn it back. Even if we eat nothing but November cakes for this week, I run back, out into the car, and sit. Finn's repair of the seat digs into my thigh.
Is this thing going to stop on us? I don't want to be stuck in the middle of some field after dark with a horse looking in. Just don't turn on the heater, Finn says.
I don't want to know how he got it started. Last time it required two men pushing it at a run while Finn steered. As we bump along the roads, he adds,
I'll bet that's where Gabe is. I'll bet he's at the festival.
And at that, I get an even more severe prickle of nerves. Because the idea of confronting Gabe over Malvern's eviction threat is one that has been dogging me. If he's at the festival, he won't be able to avoid me.
Ho!
At first, I think it's Finn who said it, even though it's not his voice, and I don't think Finn has ever said ho in his life. Then I see that it's the Carroll brothers. They're both stumping along like black guillemots in the twilight. And Jonathan shouted to get our attention. Finn lets the Morris sway to a halt. I slide the window open.
Give us a ride into town, Jonathan asks.
In response, Finn drags up the parking brake. I'm shocked, somewhat, by his boldness. I would have let the Carrolls ride with us, of course, but in my head, Finn is more shy than that. He keeps getting older while I'm not paying attention. I have to get out to let the two boys in. Jonathan climbs in first and kicks the back of Finn's seat, and Finn looks affably in the rearview mirror. Brian says thanks to me, whether for the ride or for getting out to let him in, I don't know. The car feels full of people, like we've increased our number by 5 instead of 2. As we pull off again, Jonathan leans forward and clutches the shoulders of the driver's seat to ask,
"When's the bonfire go up? Do you know?"
"I dunno," Finn replies. I twitch as a hand grips the back of my seat. A fishy smell accompanies it. I hear, "Evening, Kate." I glance back at the hand. It's a nice, square hand, even if it smells like fish. "Evening." Jonathan shakes Finn's seat.
"I think I'm legit to bet this year. Do you know if it's 16 or 17, the age to bet?"
"I don't know," Finn replies.
"Well," Jonathan says cheerfully, "you're useless as tits on a boar. Saw you setting up Dory Maud's booth yesterday morning, Puck. What's she selling these days?" "Stuff."
I don't know why he asked the question, if he was just going to answer it for himself anyway. Brian leans toward the window and me, and his voice gets a little closer. It's nice and square, like his hand. One of those old island accents that sounds good talking about the weather, or how many gannets there were on the rocks the other day. When I was younger, I used to stand in the bath where it was echoey and try to mimic it. It's something about the R's that's quite different from how my parents spoke. I hear you're going to ride. Is that true? Finn flicks on the headlights as Jonathan keeps chattering at him. Night's coming fast under the thin gauze of clouds. Something smells of burning. I hope it's not the Morris. I say, it's true. He doesn't say anything, just makes this sort of low, tuneless whistle to indicate surprise or awe, and then leans back in his seat. Meanwhile, Jonathan Carroll keeps up a running commentary with himself. He only needs to see Finn's head inclined slightly to encourage him to start up again. I'm not sure Finn's even nodding his head. I think it's just the pits in the road. As we come along the high part of the road, though, even Jonathan falls silent. From here, you can see the ocean for just a few moments. It's grey and vast under an equally vast sky, and even from this distance, I can see how the waves tear each other apart. We get plenty of rain, and storms often enough, but our weather is not given to extremes. Still, something about the white churning against the rocks is not comforting.
Ho! Jonathan says again. Look! Look there! Ahead!
And despite ourselves, we all look. The water shifts, black, then grey-blue, then black again. The froth, a white ruffled collar, and then, out of the froth, we all see it. A dark horse's head surges above the water, jaw wide open. And then, before the sea swallows the first, we see a chestnut mane break the surface, along with a brief glimpse of a brown spine curving in the water alongside it. Then, they're all gone beneath the water, and I have goosebumps creeping up my arms.
Good night to be on land, Brian Carroll says. Not lightly, like his brother would have said it. I think of the smell of fish he brought with him, and think of the plain way that he asked me if I was riding.
Riding in the races might not seem so impossibly brave to someone who fishes the November sea for a living.
If I were catching one, I'd catch that chestnut, Jonathan says. The red ones always win.
Brian says, you mean Sean Kendrick always wins. Jonathan shuffles in his seat.
I reckon chestnuts look faster.
I reckon, Brian says, Sean Kendrick makes them look that way.
Have you met him, Kate?
Finn looks amused at the Kate, probably because when Brian says it, it sounds like I'm more responsible than I really am. Yes, I mutter. I've seen him twice since we raced, but nothing about him suggested that he wanted to speak to me. In fact, sort of the opposite. He's not the kind to say, ho, either.
Queer sort, Jonathan says.
Only a water horse knows the Kapalishka better than him.
Brian Carroll's voice is admiring.
You could make worse friends than him, Kate, right now. Though I suspect you know that already.
All I know is that Sean Kendrick rode that bay mare and waited until he was nearly over the cliff edge before saving himself, and that the dead speak more than he does.
I'd bet on you, Jonathan says generously. If I wasn't betting on him.
Jonathan, this is Brian, warningly, as if I care who his dim brother is betting on.
Or Ian Privett, Jonathan concedes. He's got that wicked fast grey from last year.
He slaps a Scorpio drumbeat on the back of Finn's seat and then leans forward to speak to me.
Betting's crazy on you down at the pub, on whether you'll show up tonight for the parade. Jerry Old says that you haven't been on the beach for days and you've given up. What's-his-face says that you're dead, but obviously that's not true. So what do you think, Kate? Are you a good bet?
Brian sighs noisily. I say, if it was my horse against your mouth, not a chance. Brian and Finn laugh. Jonathan tells me I'm made of piss. I think it's a compliment. I look out the window. The sky is turning black quickly under the stripes of clouds. There's a red glow in the distance where Skarmouth crouches, but the rest of the island is black and mysterious. In the dark, there's no difference between the sea and land. I remember riding Dove on the cliff top this morning, the way the air bit my cheeks and the smell of the sea set my heart pounding. I know I should be terrified of tonight, and of tomorrow, and of the next day, and I am. But I can feel something else, too. Excitement. Chapter 29 Puck. The Riders' Parade will be at 11, Brian Carroll says. I suppose you know that already. I didn't, but now I do. 11 seems like a long way away, hours filled with the noise of the festival. I need to find my brother, I tell Brian. My other brother. In reality, what I need to find is my footing. I'm standing in this festival of mums, but I don't have mum. Finn and Jonathan Carroll have vanished off into the crowds, leaving me with Brian, whose lungs I know better than the rest of him, and a pit of snaky nerves in my stomach. I thought my statement was a goodbye, but Brian says, All right, where do you think he'll be? If I knew the answer to that, I would have spoken to him 3 days ago. The truth is, I don't know anything about my older brother these days. Brian cranes his neck to look over the crowd, scanning faces for Gabe. We're standing at the head of the main street of Skarmouth, and I can see clear down to the pier. There's people filling every inch. The only bare bit is where the Scorpio drummers make their way through far down near the water. Something smells delicious, and my stomach growls. I say, someplace I won't think to look, probably. Do you have any other brothers? Sisters, Brian says. 3 of them. Where are they tonight? The mainland. He says it without force, and I wonder if it stops stinging, or if it never stung at all. Okay, if they were here tonight, where would they be? Well, Brian says, thoughtful and slow, hard to hear above the shouted conversation around us. The key of the pub. Shall we look? Suddenly, I feel strange having this conversation with Brian Carroll. He's standing close enough to be heard, looking at me. And he seems enormous and square, and grown up with his curls and his fisherman's muscles, and the steady way he looks at me is not like I'm used to. Part of me thinks he's just humouring me. Me a kid. Him. Most of the way to man. But then part of me sees my hands in front of me. They're Mum's hands, not a little girl's hands, and I know I'm wearing Mum's face, too. I wonder how long it will take for me to feel as adult inside as I look outside. Okay, I agree. We strike off down the street. Brian's broad shoulders plough away through the people. Tourists, a lot of them, wearing unfamiliar faces. There is something subtly different about them, like they're a different species. Their noses are a little straighter, their eyes a little closer together, their mouths narrower. They're related to us like Dove is related to the water horses. There's no sign of Gabe. But how would we find him among all these people anyway? Brian keeps pressing on, though, downward in the direction of the pier. There's noise, noise, noise. Drums and shouts, laughing and singing, motorbikes and fiddles. We push our way down to the quay, which is a little quieter, flanked by ocean on one side instead of people. The water moves restlessly against the wall, closer than usual, reaching up toward us. It's quiet enough that I hear commotion from the cliffs above the town. What's going on up there? I ask. The bonfire. Brian squints up, as if he can see anything but the buildings glued to the side of the incline. That, and the sea wishes. The only thing I know of the sea wishes is that Father Mooneyham told us not to do them. I'd been unable to get more information out of Mum. Have you made a sea wish before? Brian looks stricken. No, indeed. What are they? It's a bit of paper you write on with charcoal from the bonfire.
You write something on it and toss it over the cliffs. That doesn't sound bad. A curse, Kate. They're curses. You write them backward and throw them to the sea. I'm thrilled and horrified. Immediately, I try to imagine if there is any curse that I can see myself throwing over the cliff. I pose a striking figure in my mind, silhouetted by the bonfire, hurling something foul into the ocean. You're wild, Kate Connolly, Brian says. I can see it in your face. I'm not sure about that, but when I look up at him, he's studying me intently. Suddenly and terrifyingly, I get the idea that he's going to kiss me, and I shy backward, several feet before I realize that he hasn't moved an inch. He laughs at me, a kind, safe laugh. Maybe I am wild after all. Come on, Brian says. Let's see if he's here. We continue down the quay. Here there are food vendors beneath canvas, and this is clearly where Brian thought that Gabe might be. The vendors are doing brisk trade, and we have to thread through the lines. Brian is craning his neck again to look for my brother, and again I feel strange, performing this personal quest with someone outside my family. What business of it is his, spending his festival finding Gabe instead of having a good time? You shouldn't be spending your evening doing this, I say. You should be having fun. I'll keep looking. Brian looks down at me. I think he's been getting taller throughout the evening. By the time we find Gabe, he'll be as tall as St. Columbus on the hill, and I'll have to have a stepladder to hold a conversation with him. I am having fun. Do you want me to go? I don't believe him. I've seen fun, and it involves hooting and tearing in circles, and possibly getting a skinned knee. This is interesting, not fun. I just feel guilty for keeping you. Brian swallows, and looks off over the crowd, as if he's still searching for Gabriel. The last of my sisters went to the mainland last year. Normally, I would have been here with her. Gabe says he's going. It's out before I even think of it, and immediately, I can't imagine why I said it. Why did I mention this to Brian Carroll when I haven't even really discussed it with Finn? The most detailed conversation I've had with Brian Carroll in my life involved spitting on his yet-to-be-dug grave, and now I'm turning my pockets inside out on family secrets. So he says, Brian replies. I want to shout. He didn't tell us until he had to, but that really would be a family secret. So I just seal my mouth shut. I wish I hadn't come. I wish I were at home. I wish Brian Carroll weren't looking at me from his ever-increasing height. I cross my arms and stuff them into my armpits. When I find Gabe, I'm going to punch him right in his eye. Brian Carroll seems oblivious to my distress. He adds, I think he said he was going over with Tommy Falk and Beach Grattan. I let a small noise of rage escape from me. Of course! Everyone knows! Everyone's going! Are you going to the mainland too? No, Brian says seriously. My great-great-grandfather helped build this pier, and I'm not leaving it. He sounds like he's married to it, and that suddenly makes me feel tired and cross. Hey now, Brian says, as if he has now finally discovered my annoyance. Let's go look in the pub. That's where I was headed. He might be there. That's where the locals hide sometimes. If nothing else, we can get out of the cold for a moment. We make our way back through the people to the black-eyed girl, a green-fronted building with the doors propped open. It always struck me as too distinguished to be a pub, all polished wood and dimpled leather and brass fittings. It's impeccably clean and, for most of the day, incredibly empty. Then, at night, when the sailors get tired of being sober, the pub fills up. It becomes a sort of noisy that spills out into the street and vomits into the quay. I've never been inside that second version of the pub until tonight. It's a completely different kind of full from the street. A dense, smoky, too hot claustrophobia, full of shouting and laughter and, disconcertingly, my name in conversations.
Hey now, is that our Kate Connolly? Says a man, standing by the door.
The mention of my name turns a few other heads our way. It feels like they all have more than one set of eyes each.
Kate Connolly!